Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Dankman. Emerald City Comic Con has a new home, and we're all crazy for cordyceps. It's time once again to take a trip to the nerdier side of pop culture with our panel of geekonomy experts, who have promised to follow one very important rule.
Please, no spoilers!
Yeah, no spoilers.
And remember,
no spoilers!
No spoilers.
It's simple, no spoilers. Joining me today are KUOW Arts and Culture reporter Mike Davis, friend of the show and frequent guest host here at Soundside. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Libby.
And Dyer Oxley is here. He writes the KUOW's newsletter Today So Far and produces the Northwest Nerd podcast. Hey, Dyer.
Good afternoon.
So number one, an estimated 75,000 people packed downtown Seattle in their cosplay best over the weekend for Emerald City Comic Con 2023. This was the first Comic Con in the newly expanded Seattle Convention Center. So first up, let's recap. What did you see? What did you like? What did you hate? How's the new venue, Dyer? What's up? What's good?
It's interesting you bring up the new venue because I think that is just the in-your-face big thing this year. It was hard for me just to get around the fact that there was sunlight in there. And so even though I was seeing vendors and other stuff going on there, it was almost like exploring this new space.
Does it feel like you're in a big greenhouse? From the outside, it kind of looks like just walls of glass.
So yeah, sort of. I mean, I was talking to an artist friend of mine who goes there every year. And at one moment we just stopped in our conversation because there was sunlight like coming through, and we just kind of had to comment. I'm like, wow, like no vitamin D deficiency this year. Like this was the new space is something. It is very interesting. The main show floor, it can be a little confusing. It's almost like a German levels to the floors. There's like a zero level and then the first level, you know. So the main floor is in the basement, and there's still light coming in. Wow. Down there somehow. So your big wall of glass, yeah, it is a little imposing. I mean, but there also was a Comic-Con going on too, so I guess we could talk about that.
But Dyer, did it feel a little strange? Like the glass wall is beautiful. It's an excellent touch for the convention center. But when I think of video games, I think of tabletop games, I think of, you know, myself as a kid, like huddled up and reading comics, I think dark. Like, I don't think bright light. Like, it just, I don't know. It made the setting, I noticed that, I would say.
Out of the basement into the spotlight. Was it appropriate?
Yes.
And back into another basement, I guess, because that's where the show floor is.
Mike, what did you see that stuck out to you? Any favorite cosplay, anything, any of the activities that you really liked? What did you like at the Comic-Con this year?
I had two highlights. I had two highlights. I'll give you my two highlights. My first highlight was a bad dad moment that turned into a good dad moment. I went with my 9-year-old daughter. She had never played Super Smash Brothers, and I couldn't believe it. I see
bad
the room's
dad
reaction. It was such a big part of my childhood playing Super Smash Bros. So when she walked into that room and seen it and asked me what it was, I melted. And then we probably spent a good hour and a half. She loved it. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. She wanted to play it on the Nintendo Switch. I said, no, we're definitely going to go GameCube. And it was just, it was just so fun seeing her light up. And yeah, so we had that. That was a blast from the past. Shared that with my kid. But also walking through the showroom, you know, we're walking through, we're seeing all the books and everything. And at one point, she stops at a booth and gets super excited. Like, my best friend has this book. And she starts telling me about this whole series of these graphic novels. And when she finally slows down, the woman behind the desk is like, that's so cool, I wrote this book.
That's special.
And my daughter got so shy and her eyes got big in that moment. And, you know, we definitely, I bought the graphic novel and she signed it and like did a hand drawn cartoon of one of the characters and dedicated it to my daughter. And she's been telling everybody that this is her new favorite book and she walks around with it. So those were the two highlights for me.
So that just made my heart grow three sizes hearing that, Dyer. I mean, that's really where a convention convention is at its best, right? Where you have creators there in person, getting to meet fans, getting to interact. You highlighted an issue for local creators last week on Today So Far, and it has to do with the homegrown section of Emerald City Comic Con. Tell me about what's going on with homegrown.
Yeah, I gotta say, Mike, that's the reason to go to Emerald City.
Yeah,
right there.
Beautiful.
And that's the reason why I really liked going this year. I didn't focus on much of anything other than the show floor and the artist alley. And that's where you find a lot of these locals. I found a new artist that I'm going to work with on a special project. I found some vendors. I got my nerdy bath bombs. So, I mean, there's a lot that you can get there. And it's all local. Previously, there was a homegrown section for folks who haven't gone to this convention. This was like your shop local section, is where they kind of gave some special pricing incentives for anybody who's local to kind of come here. And it wasn't just really great for shopping local. It was for all these folks who didn't necessarily fit neatly into an artist alley, or they were a vendor in a show floor. It was for some of the unique vendors that were there.
Pacific Northwest based vendors.
And they're Pacific Northwest. They didn't do it this year. And I reached out to Emerald City Comic Con, and the reasoning is, look, this event has gotten so big. We're nearly at 50% local vendors at this point. Shoving 50%, 50% is not a corner. You know, it's the whole con. So they said that they were sprinkling them throughout. If you talk to the vendors, and I do, I think the drama that kind of surrounded this year is that Emerald City Comic Con maybe was lacking in some communication, especially with talking with the vendors. It was hard not to notice that there were a lot of vendors, the local ones that everybody knows, who were not there this year. And what I also noticed was that a lot of vendors who did get in, they bought a big space, and then they said, oh, hey, you couldn't get a message from somebody? Okay, you artist. Oh, and you vendor. We'll all go into my booth.
Oh, that's cool.
And so a lot of people put like 2, 3, 4 different entities into their one booth because it was a little difficult to get everybody into. And I think everybody kind of associated that with the absence of homegrown this year.
Mike, one of the great things about a convention like this is that you have geeks of various stripes. You have the comic book folks, the cosplayers, video game players, the tabletop community, the list goes on, and they're mixing and mingling together. Obviously, the Venn diagram overlaps on a lot of those geekdoms. But underneath those killer outfits, what about the underlying diversity of who attends conventions? You did somewhat of a gut check on representation at Emerald City Comic Con. What did you notice about this when you were there over the weekend, and what did you hear?
I went to Comic Con, and I had a great time. I had a lot of fun, and I'm going to be honest, the diversity question never popped into my head, not once. I went with my daughter. I seen a lot of different people. A lot of them were wearing costumes, so like, you know, I don't know, but I think that for me, I live in Seattle, and Seattle is such a white city that when I'm in spaces that are white dominated, sometimes I just take it as a given for where I live. But my experience wasn't universal. Abby Ekenezer is an actress, writer, producer here in Seattle, and she is a major mover and shaker in the geek scene. And she says Repop used to be really engaged with DEI outreach, but there's been a change that she's noticed recently after the company went through layoffs coming out of the pandemic.
After Repop took over, one of the people who do panel creation, they wanted to spearhead diversity so much, and they wanted to actually have like a sit-down conversation. And I've never in all of my years of either working at conventions, being a part of conventions, or guesting at conventions, I've never had anyone want to sit down and say, what are we doing wrong? And I love that. Then the pandemic happened and all of those people got fired.
Okay, so Abby has seen this drop off in communication about diversity efforts at Emerald City Comic Con. Some of that she connects with layoffs that happened at the parent company, Repop. But she also mentioned other changes that she's not happy with, right, Mike? Especially about the homegrown section going away.
Absolutely. I think that Abby is upset just the lack of communication, similar to what Dyer said. And with the lack of diversity, with the lack of diverse panel representation, with the changes that made it harder for locals to actually be a part and to be able to afford booths, she's just been unhappy at how things have progressed coming out of the pandemic. And she said that she won't personally buy a ticket until things change.
Yeah, I mean, there's two sides of a coin, right? The geek communities can be so tight-knit. That outreach from ReadPop, it sounds like it was really strong early on. And then when something shifts, it's noticed. I mean, people are engaged and they realize when things maybe don't feel like they're being listened to as much as they used to be. Soundside producer Jason Burrows was at Emerald City Comic Con this weekend, too, and he's put together this great audio postcard of folks talking about what's great about being a geek in the Pacific Northwest. You can find that on our website at KUOW.org. You're listening to Soundside. When we come back, we'll talk about the heroic story of a beautiful, brilliant fungus that may have saved the video game adaptation forever. Stay with us on KUOW. You're listening to Soundside. We're back with more of our No Spoilers panel. With The Last of Us, the fine people at Home Box Office Incorporated are proving that video games can make for incredibly moving television.
If you don't think there's hope for the world, why bother going on?
You haven't seen the world, so you don't know. Keep going for family.
The show has taken over Sunday night prestige TV, inhabiting our brains, kind of like a post-apocalyptic cordyceps. I can't get enough of that.
You just had to do that.
Dyer Oxley and Mike Davis are here with me. Really, the show is elevated by these impactful performances by Pedro Pascal and Bella Ramsey as world-weary smuggler Joel and teenager with an important secret, Ellie. The finale of this critically acclaimed TV is this Sunday. Mike, what do you make of the first season so far?
Without spoilers, of course.
That's the number one rule.
No, but I thought that I was done with zombies. I thought the genre was done. I thought it was played. The Walking Dead started off so great. And I'm just like, oh, we're going to do this again.
There's a real slogging dead and near the end.
This is creative. This is creative. Man, like just if you take away the video game aspect and just look at it for what it is, visually, what they've done, the story that they're telling, the creativity, the fungus, the all of it comes together, and even for people that never heard of the video game, they still really like this show.
Yeah, Dyer.
I feel like everybody says zombie, and you know, for a very good reason, and I understand it, but I almost feel like it's a little unfair. I feel like Last of Us, yes, those aspects are there, but I don't know, if you're more into that creature feature monster type approach, I feel like it leans more into that. It's taking some cues from what we know and experience from zombies because they're so prevalent in a lot of pop culture. I think it takes things a little bit further, a new refreshing angle. But to answer more directly your question, the first season has been pretty phenomenal because I feel the key to this show, as it has been for other successful video game, comic book, other pop culture transfers into film and TV, they treat this with the maturity it deserves. They treat it like literature, which is what it is. And they don't have a bunch of people coming in to say, oh, it's just a kid's thing. Let's just make a comic film. You know, oh, it's a kid's thing. Let's make a video game. They treat this as a story, as literature, which is, I think, a little bit refreshing for folks who don't actually expect that coming.
I have never subscribed to this line of thinking that video games will always suck in movie and television form because mm-hmm. I've always had an emotional connection to video games. I mean, since Phantasy Star 2, like since one of my first like emotional connections to a video game story, I knew that this would eventually make its way onto television and movie screens. You know, I also think that there have been good adaptations. That you hear that kind of line that, oh, they always fail. They're always the 1993 Super Mario Bros. debacle. But, you know, I really loved, for example, Netflix's Castlevania adaptation. Now, granted, that's animation. It's a little bit of a different vibe, but still very adult, moody, gothic. In the case of HBO's The Last of Us, though, we have actors, sets, makeup, locations. And it's not just inhabiting a world and telling an original story with, like, an existing video game lore the way Mortal Kombat movie did, things like that. The show is really following quite closely to the plot of the actual game. Why do you think it's taken so long, Dyer, to see a good live-action video game adaptation like this?
I mean, I hate to repackage my previous answer, but I think it goes back to this, that you have to get a team who actually understands what you're dealing with. This is why, to take us out of video games and go to comic books, Marvel started its own studios. It got sick and tired of people in the film industry not taking the content seriously and producing stuff that was very below par. And it was very cheap, and they cared more about making the action figure than they did the film. And so when you get a team on board who actually takes this with a very sober mindset, a very mature mindset, they treat it for what it is. When you don't have that, I think you get some of these cliches and these bad raps that film have. Hollywood, to take us a little bit further, has a little bit of a bad rap for not being very original lately. And for very good reason. Yeah, they don't take risks. They're not being very artistic. The video games, comic books, all these geek culture properties that we have are very easy things to turn to because the work's kind of already been done. Mm-hmm. They already have writers, serious writers that have worked on them. They already have a fan base that's kind of built in. So it's almost like a silver lining to the Hollywood's lack of creativity that they've turned to where the creativity has been happening, where nobody has been looking. And I think that's partially why this stuff is worked out so well.
Mike, I heard you laughing about the Mortal Kombat 90s movie. I mean, I know there was a newer one in 2021. I actually liked it. I liked both of them. But I know you're tuned in at least to some video game adaptations. I gotta say, The Last of Us is universally almost praised for being a great game. There is this teeny tiny sliver of criticism for it from purists, which is that the gameplay elements are, you know, third-person shooting, resource management, you're raiding old rusty lockers all the time. It's somewhat of a feeling of filler to get to those huge story scenes. And some, again, the minority of voices, but some have criticized it for being more of a playable movie than a true video game. Did Craig Mazin really have a high difficulty level compared to, say, adapting like a Tomb Raider or something with just like a really simplistic storyline? I mean, he kind of just walked in and already had an amazing story, right?
Well, I think everything is connected. I think everything that Dyer said is connected to what we're talking about right now. I think, yes, that is how the game plays. But I think that you're talking about Tomb Raider. How long ago and what platform? When we're playing on PlayStation 5, these cutscenes are brilliant. Yeah. So what are they doing? They're bringing in actual storytellers to tell stories on video games. Over the last 10, 15 years or so, we're starting to see actual actors, actual voice actors come in and voice video games, right? When Uncharted dropped, that's Mark Wahlberg and Tom Holland. Like, you know what I mean? So the amount of money that we're putting into these productions, I think, is just flipping everything on its head. Like, of course it's going to be better now. And those Mortal Kombat movies, especially the first one, was terrible. But I loved it, and I'll still put that on now. But it's just nice seeing that when you actually dedicate real budgets to this type of storytelling, then of course the video games are going to be more adaptable. It's the same reason why back in the day, TV shows were always terrible and film actors looked down on television actors. But now all of the money is in series. So we're getting these brilliant, beautiful series. HBO took on this project. When I was a kid and they came out with the Dragon Ball Z movie, I don't know who made that. It's not watchable. But I would hope that they would do that again.
Nowadays, we have, you know, motion capture in video game acting, and the voice actors are actually, you know, using that motion capture technology. Do you really have a realistic, that's what The Last of Us used to kind of bring some of those scenes to life? Dyer, what do you think about that, like, purist knock that some video games get where they're being called playable movies? Like, that is a detraction from the gameplay experience.
I think this criticism is very short-sighted, and I don't think it's a valid criticism. That's my hot take here. Sorry, you're wrong.
Spicy hot.
Here's the thing. Let me take you to a glorious future called Star Trek, okay? I'm going to take us out a little bit. And in Star Trek, we have these things called holodecks, all right? That's where we're going. People, we have gone from Socrates saying, hey, written word's going to ruin our brains. You shouldn't write things down and read it, to literature and the printing press. And now we've gone into TV, where we watch it, to where we go to video games, which I think is the next step. We are now engaged with the story. Bringing us further and further engaged into storytelling is where this is going. A lot of people see this as, oh, it's just a video game. No, this is the future of storytelling. Folks that are into books, you bookworms, this is the future of your fandom. It's going there. Eventually, yes, hopefully we will walk into holodecks and we will actually be in a Sherlock Holmes story.
The problem is those darn holodecks are always taking over the ship.
Yeah, okay.
The safety features are always getting turned off.
Aside from the evil AIs, aside from that, that's essentially where we're going to go. So when I see these video games creating really, really well-done stories that folks are engaged with, I just see, look, that's the future where we're going. You know, you can either be... You know, with all his credit, Socrates saying, no, don't write things down, to, yeah, we're going to be engaged with these stories heavily in the future.
And just to piggyback on that, because Dyer couldn't be more right in everything that he said, Libby, NBA 2K has cutscenes that force you to watch. Yes, yes, you think you're getting on the game to play basketball, and you're watching all of these cutscenes, and your player can become a rapper or an actor and all of this, and it's because...
Triple threat.
Storytelling. People want story. It's the best time in the world to be a storyteller. Take it from the guy that read every single book in the Wheel of Time series, one of the longest series ever written. I love that Amazon Prime show, and I was so afraid at first, but they put the resources behind it to actually tell the story, and it's amazing.
Mike, my eyes are like gonna fill up with tears. You read all of The Wheel of Time. I read all of The Wheel of Time.
Every
we have spent
book.
So many hours with that.
How have we not
Robert
talked about
Jordan
that?
Universe.
I
wow.
bought the comics at Comic-Con.
Oh, my God.
Now, if they made you a video game or a hologram or whatever where you could walk into The Wheel of Time, would you do it?
I'd live there.
There you go.
Did Mark Zuckerberg get to you? Because this is like metaverse propaganda.
All right, let's not throw that on me.
Okay, guys, it's a big time for adaptations of all kinds of nerdy content. You already brought up, you know, novels, Dyer. What adaptations are you into lately? What are you watching and what makes them good?
I'll throw out there, it's already happened, but Halo came in and went. I think it was on Paramount streaming. Yes, it had some criticisms there. Yes, the CGI was a little difficult. However, I think they actually pulled that off really well. I think Halo, it did pretty good. That's another adaptation. It's not an adaptation, however, right now, as far as geek culture goes, I'm really enjoying The Mandalorian kicking off again and my Picard, which has been a very pleasant surprise for me.
Final season. I'm getting Picard. Emotional seeing the art, all the old gang back together.
Don't start.
Mike, what are you watching lately?
As I've said, The Wheel of Time. I'm definitely waiting for The Wheel of Time to come back. That's been a fun one. I also like what Amazon Prime is doing with The Lord of the Rings. Like that new series, I had a lot of fun watching that as well.
Rings of Power, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. So those are the two that got me right now.
All right. I'm looking forward to the second season of Shadow and Bone because I read all of Leigh Bardugo's Grishaverse. They're young adult novels. They're really fun. And after the first season was a pretty good hit on Netflix, they got a second season and I decided to turn to the books. It was a really fun introduction, like going unusually. I don't usually do this, but going from a screen version to the books was a kind of a cool way to experience it. Although you're then trapped in your... in the Netflix understanding of what those characters look like and how they move through the world rather than your own understanding.
Can I give you one more for the kids out there? Bean and Ivy is a very popular book series. They adapted some of those books on Netflix and we've watched them. They're fun.
Can I take the temperature in the room on this one here? Because I have a feeling this is going to, I'm almost scared. Walking Dead spinoffs coming this year. Okay, all right. Everybody just gave a communal groan out there.
I'm so tired. I'm just tired.
I'm done.
That's why The Last of Us, you know, Mike was saying it best. The Last of Us revived the zombie genre for me. Okay, I get it, Dyer. Like, maybe they're more like puppets. They're more like mushroom puppets, right?
Can I push back on Dyer on that, too? Because Dyer doesn't want The Last of Us to be... That's a zombie story. The way that story moves, the way they go from... Oh, I can't spoil it, but... All of the tent poles of any zombie series, zombie movie, how the humans interact with the zombies, then how the humans interact with humans. That's The Last of Us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think it brings a really refreshing look on it, though, too.
When you actually do come across
the big bad, I don't know. I had creature feature vibes kind of coming from, but that was a little bit new to me, too. But I only mentioned Walking Dead because I knew that maybe it was going to sour some moods. So I was being a little...
How much content they can get out of that series. Just really incredible. The zombie genre lives on and will always live on, much like the zombies themselves. Thanks to my panel today, Dyer Oxley, KUOW newsletter author and producer of the Northwest Nerd Podcast, and Mike Davis, KUOW arts and culture reporter. I had fun, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. By the way, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.